A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thanks so much for being a part of this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. I think this is the last day that I'll be wearing flannel. I thought it was going to be last week. We got back up into the 80s in Virginia, and this week it cooled down again. Things starting to heat back up in Virginia, not only in terms of the weather, but also as we get closer to the effective date of Governor Ralph Northam's gun control laws, which will be July the 1st. We've got some coverage about that at bearingarms.com. Now, originally, Carol Markowitz from the New York Post was going to join me on the program today, but she had a bit of a last-minute thing come up, so we'll try to reschedule and get Carol back on the program in the near future. In the meantime, though, I've got to take on this piece by Kate McClure. It's at the Lansing State Journal. McClure is or was the legal counsel and policy analyst for the Michigan Senate Democratic Caucus. And she's a former law and policy columnist for the Detroit Legal News. And she has a piece of the Lansing State Journal arguing that gun stores are not essential. And she has a real problem with the fact that the lawmakers in Michigan, Republican lawmakers, have introduced a bill that would prohibit Governor Whitmer or any future governors from infringing on the right to keep and bear arms during a state of emergency. So let's go through this column together, shall we? It'll be an adventure. It'll be an exploration of some really, really bad ideas and some dumb opinions. McClure starts out by saying, amid pictures of gun-toting protesters at Michigan's Capitol, nationwide complaints by the National Rifle Association that gun stores are not included in essential services under stay-at-home orders and skyrocketing gun sales since the pandemic started, Michigan Senate Republicans recently joined the fray by introducing two bills, Senate Bill 859 and Senate Bill 860, which would prohibit any Michigan governor from banning the sale or purchase of firearms during a disaster. Now, it should be noted, because McClure will not, that this is not unusual. This is not uncommon. This is not the first piece of legislation introduced around the country that would prohibit governors from infringing on people's constitutional right to keep and bear arms during a state of emergency. In fact, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, we had about two dozen states around the country adopt these similar rules, including, by the way, the state of Virginia, where now governor and then state senator Ralph Northam actually voted in favor of this legislation. Yeah, how about that? McClure makes it seem like this is some weird thing that Michigan Senate Republicans have come up with, when in fact, this is the law of the land in about half of the states in the country. McClure says, in the pandemic-driven disaster that we currently face, despite an array of allegations to the contrary, there are no legal or public policy reasons to include gun stores as essential services in any of the stay-at-home orders in existence across the country. That's what we call an opinion, not a fact here. And it's up to McClure to back up her opinion with facts. She can't. She absolutely can't. She says the NRA and their affiliates have filed multiple lawsuits against New York, New Jersey, and California, among others, alleging that mandatory gun store closures amount to a violation of the Second Amendment. Yet U.S. constitutional law, she writes, has always allowed for the curtailment of Bill of Rights guarantees where necessary to protect public health and where the restrictions are of general applicability and neutral, such as they do not single out a particular activity or organization. Well, listen, here's the thing. In Michigan, for example, Governor Whitmer declared that life-sustaining businesses would be allowed to remain open. That's already singling out certain businesses and declaring that others are not life-sustaining. So already, I think her argument is on shaky ground, particularly as we've seen a number of states start to drop the essential, non-essential designations, because we realize that all businesses are essential. Even if they're essential only to the employees and the owner of the business, they're still essential. As to the fact that gun stores in some states have been ordered closed, McClure talks about the lawsuits that have been filed, at least some of them, but she doesn't actually mention, for example, the lawsuit that was filed in Massachusetts, where a U.S. district judge, Judge Douglas Woodlock, actually granted an injunction blocking Governor Charlie Baker's closure of gun stores. Why? because it was unconstitutional. Looking here at a story from Law 360, this was written right after the hearing where Judge Woodlock was able to ask questions of both sides. He repeatedly pressed government attorneys for the state's rationale and asked them to work with retailers challenging the closures to draft a plan on how these stores could safely reopen in case he decides the Second Amendment demands it. The attorney for the state of Massachusetts, Assistant Attorney General Julie Jakobik, said, quote, in times of crisis, the government is entitled to draw lines and is entitled to deference in how it draws lines in determining what is essential for human survival. I don't know, she said, why gun stores were not included, but liquor stores were. But that government should be allowed to simply pick and choose which businesses are life-sustaining. Judge Woodlock said, yeah, governments are owed deference at the macro level, but he also said you're not freed from every responsibility. And he said, you know, it could be that maybe the liquor lobby appealed to Governor Baker. And maybe Governor Baker listened to the liquor lobby, but he didn't listen to the Second Amendment lobby. He said, quote, now we're dealing with the micro level. And deference doesn't fall like the mists over San Clemente. It requires a sober analysis of the responsibilities of those who sell various kinds of commodities. And in the absence of any contemporaneous explanation, what it is that could distinguish those two, the line is drawn to burden constitutional rights and not sumptuary rights. He said, in the absence of real justification or a real outline of what these distinctions are, it's really difficult to give deference to the concerted silence on the part of the administrators who are required to make these decisions. Going back to McClure's argument, she says, again, that, you know, listen, these regulations in Michigan, they don't single out a particular activity or organization. Well, again, according to Judge Woodlock, they don't have to. The government still has to explain why closing gun stores is going to benefit the public health, but allowing marijuana retailers to remain open is also going to benefit the public health. And in Michigan, marijuana retailers were considered life-sustaining businesses. Gun stores were not. McClure can't really talk about and certainly doesn't mention the fact that there are a lot of businesses that we may or may not think are life-sustaining that we're allowed to reopen, and that there are businesses that are, in fact, a part of our constitutional rights that were ordered to close. McClure writes that the numerous state and municipal stay-at-home orders currently in place, including ours in Michigan, have necessity impact many of the rights that we cherish, the right to assemble, the right to practice religion, and the right to free speech among the most obvious. They correctly do so in order to limit the spread of the virus to a level that our public health system can manage, and they are of general applicability, impacting as they do all normal activity except that which is essential to sustaining life. Again, I think, by the way, she's painted with a very broad brush. If she's talking about all of these various stay-at-home orders, I don't think that that's the case with every stay-at-home order that's been on the books. McClure goes on to say, with our First Amendment rights so limited, why should the right to bear arms be treated differently? The stay-at-home orders do not, in fact, even directly implicate the right to own a gun, only the right to buy a new gun during this unprecedented, albeit limited, period. There is no legal justification for elevating this right over others. Again, it's not about elevating a right over others. It's about looking at all of these public safety measures and determining, okay, does this make sense? Is there a fit here? McClure talks about church services, for example. She says, you know, listen, there are people who can't go to church, or there are, you know, limits on the number of attendees for a church service. How's that any different than ordering gun stores to close? And I would say it's very different. Which is not to say, by the way, that I believe that these orders for churches to not have in-person services or things of that nature are constitutional. I think they should be challenged as well. But I also think it's one thing to say, listen, you know, a church service can't have any more than 10 people in person, but you can still stream the service live. You can have maybe drive-up services where you stay in your car and you listen to the service over the radio in the church parking lot. That's a very different thing than saying gun stores must shut their doors. They can't have 10 people inside at one time. They can't operate curbside as the ATF has allowed them to do. They simply cannot conduct any firearm sales or transfers at this time and for the foreseeable future. Those are apples and oranges here. And I think the curtailment, the utter curtailment of the ability to acquire a firearm is a little bit different. And it's a much bigger burden on the Second Amendment than having to listen to your pastor in the church parking lot is on your First Amendment rights. Again, I think they're both challengeable in court, but if I got to say, you know, one is a more egregious infringement, I'm going with the closure of gun stores. Now, McClure goes on to say, how can the NRA and its affiliates justify the precious governmental time and resources that they're taking up with these apparently meritless lawsuits? Well, again, they're not apparently meritless. There have been governor's orders that have been struck down by federal courts for violating the Second Amendment rights of residents. That, to me, proves that these lawsuits have merit. And it proves to me that McClure is a dishonest broker for her argument. She's not presenting both sides. She's not presenting facts to her readers and letting them decide for themselves whether or not she's right. She's presenting one side of the story. She's ignoring cases like the Massachusetts case because it doesn't suit her argument. It doesn't fit her argument. And I suspect she doesn't have a good response to Judge Woodlock in Massachusetts. She goes on to say, there is certainly no justification for these lawsuits on public policy grounds. At a time when anxiety levels of all Americans are at an all-time high, with suicide and domestic violence hotlines overwhelmed across the country, it is not in the public interest to allow continued gun sales while disallowing the right to leave one's house for social and religious support. Trump administration policy guidelines to the contrary, gun stores should not be treated the same as grocery stores, pharmacies, and hospitals. Well, what about hardware stores? What about banks? What about laundromats? What about other businesses? Again, most states are now starting to move towards this model where there is no essential, non-essential business. Because that is the government picking and choosing losers. You get to stay in business, you don't get to stay in business. Oh, you're a big box retailer? Well, you can sell garden seeds. Oh, you're a garden supply store? Well, you can't. You've got to stay closed. That makes no sense. Absolutely no sense. And Kate McClure talks a lot about the power that the government should have, but she doesn't talk about the reasoning that the government needs to use in setting these guidelines, in ordering these mandates. Instead, it's simply all about the power. By the way, I would also say, she says it's not right. It's not in the public interest to allow continued gun sales while disallowing the right to leave one's house for social and religious support. Well, how about, rather than shutting down gun stores, we allow people to leave their homes for social and religious support? I mean, that seems like a better way to go about it. Not to Kate McClure. Oh, no. McClure says the point of this analysis, which, by the way, is not analysis at all, is not just to question the gun lobby on their dubious litigation and public policy strategy in a time of a pandemic. Focusing again on those Michigan Senate bills, the point instead is to highlight that in times of disaster, governments must have the power and flexibility to weigh otherwise guaranteed personal freedoms against whatever health and safety contingencies the disaster brings. Again, I'll go back to Judge Woodlock in Massachusetts, who said, sure, listen, governments have deference at the macro level. Governments have deference in times of emergencies to set their own rules. But at the micro level, they are not freed from all responsibilities, and they still have to justify their decisions. McClure says the bills in Michigan would take that flexibility away and, in effect, place gun rights above First Amendment rights and the other personal guarantees of our state and federal constitutions. From a legal standpoint, she says, there's little doubt that these bills would therefore be found unconstitutional. From a public policy standpoint, the current crisis gives solid evidence that such an approach is extremely unwise. Well, first of all, I don't know where she's getting this idea that these laws would be considered unconstitutional, because they are on the books, again, in about half the states of this country, including the state that I live in, the state of Virginia. And no state court, no federal court has found the law prohibiting the governor from banning the transfer of firearms to be unconstitutional. Quite the contrary. In fact, we have a judge in Lynchburg, Virginia, who found that Governor Ralph Northam's executive order closing indoor gun ranges overstepped his constitutional authority. And he did not just use the law that was put on the books that Northam voted for back in 2012 that prohibits the governor from infringing on the Second Amendment rights of residents during a state of emergency. That state judge also looked at the U.S. Constitution and the Virginia State Constitution and said the governor can't do what he's doing here. Now, that judge's ruling applied only to one indoor range, the range that had brought the lawsuit, Safeside Tactical in Lynchburg, Virginia. But now indoor ranges are starting to reopen around the state. Governor Northam and the Attorney General, Mark Herring, did not appeal that judge's decision. No pun intended, bit the bullet and took the loss in court. I think an attempt to avoid a broader smackdown by the Virginia State Supreme Court. McClure is off base. And again, she's either ignorant of the facts on the ground, or she is intentionally deceiving her audience by not telling them all of the facts on the ground. And either way, the editors of the Lansing State Journal should have done a better job of fact-checking this piece. And frankly, they shouldn't have allowed it to run as it is. I am tempted to reach out to Cade McClure. I don't know that she would come on this program, but I am tempted to reach out and to try to have this conversation with her to get into this debate, because I think she is flat out wrong on the facts. I think the merits of her argument are sorely lacking. And at the end of the day, even in a state of emergency, yeah, our right to keep and bear arms still shall not be infringed. All right, so I'm going to climb off my soapbox now, and we'll get to our good deed of the day, our armed citizen story, our recidivist report. We will start there with a story out of Horry County, South Carolina, where a man once wanted for attempted murder has pled guilty to a lesser charge and has received nothing more than probation. Yeah, for shooting somebody. I know. I'm a little concerned about this as well. Anthony Michael Gore pled guilty to an assault charge on Thursday after originally being charged with attempted murder. He was given a 5-year prison sentence that was suspended to 4 years probation. He was arrested in Wilmington, North Carolina back in October after allegedly shooting somebody who had tried to intervene during a domestic dispute in the town of Loras, South Carolina. Now, here's the thing. I went back and I looked at the original arrest report, and Gore originally was arrested, as a fugitive from justice, attempted murder, and possession of a firearm by a felon. So he shot somebody with a gun that he's not legally allowed to own, and yet prosecutors in this case reduced the charges, allow him to plead guilty, and to get away with probation. The felon in possession charge, if this had been sent to the U.S. Attorney's Office, for example, could have resulted in a 10-year federal prison term for Gore. And instead, he's not going to spend any time behind bars. He's getting off with probation. Absolutely unbelievable. Our armed citizen story today, also from South Carolina, Aiken County, South Carolina. Story breaking Thursday morning. Fox 54 says that a homeowner in Aiken County called 911, say that they had shot at three suspects who were trying to break into their home. Again, this is early Thursday morning. One of the suspects is in custody, according to officers. The sheriff's office says the suspect suffered a gunshot wound to the hand, was taken to a local hospital. The two other suspects currently outstanding. They believe that they fled the area on foot. They are continuing to investigate. Hopefully we'll have an update for you on that breaking news situation. And finally today, our good deed of the day from Fox 5 in Atlanta, Georgia, Marietta, Georgia, where officers went the extra mile to help a homeless veteran. Fox 5 says, for months, police in Marietta had received calls about a guy in a wheelchair at the intersection of Cherokee Street and Canton Road. He was sitting outside a gas station. Sometimes he'd be in the middle of the road. A lot of folks, you know, went up and approached him and said, hey, are you doing okay? Can I do anything? The guy always said, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. And then one day, police officer Landon Brooks decided he really wanted to spend some time getting to know this guy named Ronnie. He learned that the man in the wheelchair was a military veteran suffering from PTSD. He was also a father. Officer Brooks said he spoke about his family and his son that he hadn't seen in a while, but he needed help, he said, and he was ready to get help. Barbara Martin is a Marietta resident. She had also tried to befriend Ronnie. She said it takes a village and it takes everybody working together to help individuals. So Barbara Martin and Officer Landon Brooks got together and started talking. Okay, what can we do to help Ronnie? They contacted various agencies, said, listen, you know, here's the deal. We've got this veteran. He's got some issues that he wants to deal with. Eventually, they were able to develop a long-term plan where he could get the mental and physical help that he needs. He could get off of the streets and into a warm bed. Officer Brooks says, I think the community getting together with him and building that rapport and us being able to offer our services is what might have saved his life. And now Ronnie is getting the help that he needs. Hopefully, he will be reunited with his family in the very near future. And again, all because Officer Landon Brooks and Barbara Martin and other folks in the community in the right place at the right time and willing and able to do the right thing to help out this homeless veteran. We thank you for your very, very good deed. That is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. We will be back tomorrow. Now, just a program note, this is Memorial Day weekend, so we will not have a new Cam and Company coming up on Monday of next week. And right now, I am planning on taking my first day off since, I guess my first day off of 2020, at least my first vacation day of 2020. I have some stuff that I got to do around the farm, so right now, the plan is we'll be back with Cam and Company next Wednesday, but we will have, again, a new show for you coming up on Friday, May 22nd. We will have all of the latest Second Amendment news and information for you. But in the meantime, don't forget, you can subscribe to Town Hall Media on YouTube or Bearing Arms Cam and Company on Apple Podcasts or any of the other fine podcast platforms. That way you never miss one of these programs. And if you become a VIP Gold member, you can go back and you can check out the fantastic live chat that I did yesterday with Ed Morrissey and Sam J. Foo from Twitchy. It was a great time, some great questions. I want to thank each and every one of you for participating. We certainly do appreciate your support, the support of VIP Gold members that allows us to do the Second Amendment journalism that we do here each and every day at Cam and Company and BearingArms.com. Until we talk again, which again will be tomorrow, be safe, be well, be free, and we'll see you soon with another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company.